From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Richard Lautendresse of Canadian broadcaster TVA Nouvelle and Emily Tamkin, a writer for the magazine Foreign Policy. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The Trump administration finds trade looming large in its priorities as it prepares for another round of trade talks with China, while President Trump angered allies and surprised members of his own party by announcing tariffs against the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. The summit scheduled to take place in early June between the United States and North Korea remained in limbo, but efforts to rescue the summit continue. In Italy, a coalition government has finally been agreed, ending months of uncertainty in the European Union's fourth biggest economy. But the tenuous coalition is promising internal changes that will almost certainly lead to conflict, both internally and externally. And a dramatic rescue in France captures the imagination of the world and reaps a special reward for the man who is responsible. So, let's get started, panelists. Let's start off with trade. And I think at the beginning of the week, we had thought about this being only China trade, and now it's sort of turned into a global trade situation. The White House announced plans to slap 25% tariffs on $50 billion of imports from China, reversing a position of, less than 2 weeks ago. They talked about having tariffs being on hold as talks progressed. The announcement was meant to give leverage for Wilbur Ross and his talks in China. China predictably reacted with tariffs of its own. And simultaneously, you had the Trump administration announcing massive tariffs against the European Union, Canada, and Mexico on aluminum and steel. So, Richard, I'll start with you. What is the objective of the Trump administration in this latest round of tariffs?
It looks like a tactic to, as far as Canada and Mexico are concerned, a tactic to have them make the ultimate concession to finally get the NAFTA agreement they want. They've been negotiating for 9 months. I think there is a will, it sounds, and we read this from, again, in the last days, Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, a will to show the entire commercial partners of the U.S. that they will hit everybody to make sure that the deals they'll get will be good for the American workers. We know the narrative. And so even their allies, even Canada, a close ally as Canada, will suffer if they don't get this, what they want. So it looks to me like just another way of negotiating, the Trump way of negotiating, by using the stick very, very early.
Emily, I'm going to go to you. This round of tariffs, again, you could start with China or go to Mexico, Canada. There's so much to talk about on all of these fronts. But in a general sense, do you feel that the tactics are good politics, good policy, both or neither?
So I think that if there's one driving ideology that Trump has displayed, it's this idea that he individually and the country in generally has been taken advantage of. Now, given his own status in life, he holds. And I think that you need to see this in the context of that. So these steel and aluminum tariffs on our closest allies, those are meant to, one, show that Trump and the United States won't be pushed around anymore, and two, to get to the issue of oversupply from China. But the issue there is that these countries are those with which he would have been working to crack down on Chinese oversupply, right? So the way to get your allies to do something is not necessarily to slap tariffs against which they've already vowed to retaliate. I already saw news coming out yesterday, or opinions coming out yesterday, saying, well, we're being harder on our closest allies than we are on China, because yes, there were these tariffs on China, but there was also talk of the ZTE telecom company being allowed to conduct business with the United States. There was some talk of concessions being made for Ivanka Trump's businesses. Yeah. This idea that it's not America first or America's allies first, as the American Transatlantic Alliance first, as much as it is those who benefit from the Trump administration first.
And so there is that feeling and that sense, we've talked about that on this air other times, about that sense of quid pro quo, I think you want to call
absolutely
it in that sense. On the other hand, Richard, I have to say that when you look at things objectively, the Trump administration has done things that have kind of set the economy free by a number of measures. The economy is doing very, very, very well. When you contrast that with this particular policy, and I'm going to read a tweet real quick here by U.S. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska. He said, you know, essentially, this is dumb. Europe, Canada, and Mexico are not China, and you don't treat allies the same way you treat opponents. We've been down this road before. Blanket protectionism is a big part of why America had a Great Depression. Make America great again shouldn't mean make America 1929 again. That's a very tough statement by a member of his own party. Where do you draw the line between aggressive trade policy and reckless trade policy?
You draw the line at the president's feeling of the day. If the president feels one way one day, he goes one way, and if he has another feeling. And this morning again, I was reading that Commerce Secretary Ross was reminding everyone, and he had said it before, that the president has the authority unilaterally to do anything he wishes at any point. So if the president feels at the moment that this is the way, the tactic to use to gain, it looks, especially from a Canadian perspective, but it looks like he fundamentally wants to please an electorate base that is influenced by a certain type of economic perspective. You're talking about heavy industries. You're talking about mining world. You know, we know very well a certain America that has lost a lot in the last 20 years because of free trade agreements, but also, you know, it's a different economy that is transforming.
We're talking about manufacturing. It's very easy.
We are mainly talking about manufacturing, and Ben Sasse actually referred to the fact that the economy the president would like to bring back is the economy of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century one. It has changed since then. So you were asking me, Michael, at what point do you feel that, okay, this is a too much or it's just enough? Well, if the president uses this as a way to show his electorate that he's doing something concrete to satisfy their expectations. And that's why, you know, there was yesterday, Prime Minister Trudeau was asked by colleagues in Canada why all his economic arguments failed to convince the U.S. president that it was a bad idea to impose those tariffs. And he said, well, you have to ask the president about that. I have no clue. We just can't really see a rational way of, besides the political perspective, a rational way to get to this point.
And the lack of communication between parties, both allies and internally, but within the party, seems to be one of the issues here, that people seem to be caught wrong-footed many times by tweets and announcements that have been countered to things that they have recently said. Forgetting the politics, leaving that aside for now. China now is on the move, where the U.S. is receding from international agreements, multilateral agreements. And you see China courting countries that have been touched by these protectionist policies. And they're promoting their own trade alliances. They're promoting even leveling charges against the U.S. in the WTO. Donald Trump seeks to make President Xi a partner, but is he actually helping him to rise above the United States in terms of its influence in the world trade order?
The United States is not only powerful in the World Trade Order because it's very rich, although that is certainly a part of it, right? It's because it helped or just wrote the rules of this international trade order. And it did that by finding partners who would sort of get in line and work with it. Those partners were slapped with tariffs yesterday. The way that Prime Minister Trudeau spoke about the American people versus the American government is the way that Trump and Pompeo speak about the difference between the powers that are in Iran versus the Iranian people, or the way that Senator John McCain differentiates between Putin and the Russian people. You know, if we're talking about who's going to lead the international order on trade, I don't know that we can say that it's the United States right now. And I think what should also be noted is that it's not that China is just going to walk into the space that the United States walked out of, right? It's going to look different, and it won't be based on some of the rules that the United States up to this point worked very hard to keep in place.
Right. It would be a different order, a different game, different rules.
Yes.
Totally. Totally agree with that. One of my positions, Richard, is that most hot wars have been trade wars at the beginning. They were about trade issues, commerce routes, trade, travel, these sorts of things. They were trade wars at some point. Is there a chance that one of these trade wars could actually turn into a hot war? And I don't foresee guns being turned across the Canadian border anytime soon. But certainly in Asia, you have tensions that are high in certain places with the militarization of the South China Sea and et cetera. Is there a chance that one of these things could touch off some sort of military conflict that could escalate into a full-blown war?
I think the word is escalation. I think there's a risk. There's obviously a risk that if it's perceived from the U.S. as a systematic position of enforcing their own view on trade without considering allies or other economies, then it's like the outcome is unavoidable. We can easily imagine a radicalization of the position from the other side. Of course, we're not going to fight between Canadians and Americans. But indeed, in the South China Sea and in Southeast Asia, you see that if there is no other options, then a spark can be, and the smallest little thing can end up being the source of a conflict. My worry, Michael, is that before getting to a military confrontation, we're going to have, you know, harder and harder trade barriers being put in place. When you start doing this, the economies are transformed themselves, and then they try to compensate the loss from one side to the other. And then it's going to take just longer. I mean, you were talking, and I'm just going to conclude on this. You were starting by saying the economy is doing well thanks to deregulation. The businesses like it, but still, the day it's going to start falling apart, I think with all those barriers, we won't find easy exit out of this.
I think we can all agree that confrontation sometimes comes from lack of cooperation, and mm-hmm. certainly this type of action will promote that sort of thing. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll get back to the issues in just a moment.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Richard Lattendress of Canadian broadcaster TVA Nouvelle, and Emily Tamkin, a writer for the magazine Foreign Policy. Our moderator is CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Now back to the issues. North Korea, the summit that was originally scheduled, and I guess still is scheduled for June 12, is somewhat in disarray. President Trump had canceled the meeting, some reports saying in anticipation that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was about to do so. Both parties have left the door slightly ajar, if not open, to have these meetings. Emily, we have high-ranking officials that are still having meetings mm-hmm. ongoing, seemingly around the clock now, in various places around the world. Who's meeting, and has there been any progress in reestablishing the June 12th summit?
There have certainly been meetings. I don't know that there has been substantive progress. And what I mean by that is, you know, there are meetings in New York. There have been meetings in Singapore. There are reports that a very high-ranking North Korean official is in Washington, D.C. for more meetings. But the issues that were at hand, and some of the discussions, I should say, are apparently about like which venue they're going to use. That can probably be resolved, right?
With the logistical things.
Sure. Yes. And those are important. And these things are very highly coordinated and orchestrated and normally take months of work.
Interesting,
right?
That it's happening within 2 weeks of the time that it's meant to.
Yes. But the reason that Trump wrote the breakup letter to the summit in the first place is that there were core issues that were not resolved. So we're still not clear on who means what on denuclearization. South Korean leader Moon Jae-in is trying to get South Korea into the meeting, so maybe they would come on June 13th. There's sort of discord or debate within the American side as to whether or not that would be helpful or be a distraction. There are still some core issues that, despite all the meetings, and there are very senior people who have worked on these issues for years who are working on it now. We haven't been able to resolve, you know, sort of what denuclearization means up to this point. I don't know that we're going to get that settled in the next 11 days before the possible date of the summit.
Richard, Donald Trump wrote in his letter to Kim canceling the meeting, there's an interesting sentence that stood out to me. There were several interesting sentences, this one in particular. He quotes, "I felt a wonderful dialogue was building up between you and me," that's him and Kim, "and ultimately it is only that dialogue that matters." So the fact that we have, and it's an oddly emotional way to phrase a relationship between two world leaders, I might like preface this with, but is that an accurate statement, though? In fact, that it is only the dialogue that happens between Donald Trump and the North Korean leader at the table that will decide this thing, despite all of the preparations, all of the groundwork that's laid, it could be any one of two or three sentences that's passed between these two that ultimately decides the success or failure.
That's the impression he has. And that's probably, his impression comes from his own experience, but also the advice he received from, for instance, Barack Obama. When he left, Barack Obama told him, President Obama told him, North Korea was a fundamental threat to security and peace in the Pacific. So Donald Trump obviously has concluded that nobody else has been able to reach anything to bring North Korea back into some sort of active dialogue, conversation with the rest of the world. I will be the one to embody this link between North Korea and the rest of the country. So the country. So yes, I think he sees this as a personal impact he can have on world peace or and in the region.
I think that the quality that Barack Obama and Donald Trump share, if there's one quality that they share, is a tremendous confidence in their own personal persuasion. And you can judge for yourselves which is more, and certainly different styles, but they do ultimately share that confidence in their own ability to sway someone with their personal gravitas. That being said, Emily,
I was just going to say that there were two sort of issues with that sentence, right? That their dialogue was the only one that matters. The first is that it's sort of, I mean, as Richard was saying, yes, we understand that Donald Trump has this great belief in his own abilities as a deal maker, and that in his mind he's going to get in a room with Kim and that'll be it. But it's a factually incorrect statement that the only dialogue that matters is that between the U.S. leader and North Korea. I already mentioned Moon and South Korea. Moon matters, or South Korea matters. Shinzo Abe of Japan and Japan matter. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov was meeting with North Korean leaders this week. Russia matters. China matters. You know, we were talking earlier about, the American electorate, the American base. Every country has, if not a democratic electorate, then people who its leaders need to satisfy and keep safe, and who they need to be seen, who need to see them as protecting. So the idea that this is one dialogue and that's it and that resolves the issue, it's just not true.
You walked right into my question.
You're trapped.
That was awesome. So China's, as Emily says, China's importance is undisputable. And whether it will be a facilitator or a negotiator is really sort of up for grabs. I want to ask you, Richard, just characterize this. If this summit actually happens, or whenever it happens, what is the biggest win that could happen for both sides? And what is the biggest loss for both sides?
Well, this is a huge question. Like, well, the biggest win, obviously, would be if North Korea accepted to even a long-term or medium-term dismantle its nuclear program and reintegrate the world community by being less of a threat for the countries in the region, the U.S. allies in particular. That would be a major win. It's just, at the moment, unfathomable that the Pyongyang regime would accept to do this. That's the only reason why they're at the table at the moment, is because they have their nuclear arsenal.
So, and you have people talking about a Libya solution still.
Yes, and the Libya solution
Libya
is in two options, which is two things. Muammar Gaddafi giving up his nuclear program, yes, and 10 years later, or a little less than that, being pushed away. So it would be a major win for the Western world, for the U.S. allies in the region and the United States, if North Korea were to do this, and probably because Donald Trump would open the floodgates of aid and businesses and all this, if this is what North Korea wants, it could have a very dynamic, very fruitful economic partnership with the U.S. The loss I see is that if we do not get to a point where we're successful, they go back home with their guns and their missiles, and we go back home with no other option than to start threatening each other.
And presumably that would not be a happy parting if that happened. Your take on that one?
I think that the stakes are obviously very high. If we, being the global community, gets this wrong, is my short take. And we're dealing with some very methodical actors and some very rash individuals. And the stakes, I don't really think, could be any higher.
Yeah, I kind of agree there.
Yeah.
good place to put a pin in that one. Let's talk for a couple of minutes about the Italian government, mm-hmm. which I kind of found fascinating. They should be set to music, actually. Yeah. After months of uncertainty, a new government is sworn in with a relative political newcomer, Giuseppe Conte, as PM. A coalition of two partners there forming the government that both have unconventional views on the future of Italy and also Italy's relationship with the European Union. Emily, I'll start with you. I found it interesting to read that Italy has had 64 parliamentary governments since World War II. This is the 64th. Who's forming this government? Why has it been so difficult?
So this government is between the Five Star Movement and the League, so two sort of populist, I think the word that they would prefer, parties. Yep. In Italy. And originally, so as you say, Prime Minister Conte put together a first, or soon to be Prime Minister Conte, I guess, put together a first government. The president rejected it because the finance minister, Mr. Savona, was very anti-euro, like not the currency, I mean, an anti-eurozone.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, there were some people saying this is a coup, this is not respecting democratic norms. The response of others was, yes, they have a mandate, but no, that mandate does not involve leaving the eurozone. So then basically the same players came back, but there was a reshuffle, and now the anti-eurozone would-be finance minister is the anti-eurozone European Affairs minister which I was sort of like, is that better? And the two parties tried to sort of like they were like painting over Basta Euro signs, like enough Euro signs on their headquarters. You know, as you said earlier, this is the fourth largest economy in Europe. France and Germany were already having sort of discussions and debates about what Eurozone reforms would look like. This throws a huge wrench into that. But I think also more broadly, other European leaders and political sort of mainstream political parties were saying, well, you know, we can't take in immigrants because if we do, our own far-right parties will win. Okay, fine. Italy, just sort of because of geography, right, took in many a migrant, many an asylum seeker. And now, Europe, you do have this, you're going to have to deal with the reality of your refusal to sort of share this, I don't want to use the word burden, but share this responsibility. It fell very heavily on Italy's shoulders. And now there's a populist government, truly and not the geographic heart, but the political heart of Europe.
I'll go to you, Richard, for the final word on this topic. Could Brexit be followed by Ciao Italia?
Ciao Italia. That would be an even bigger shock, probably, because the Italian were part of the construction of the initial group, you know, the Communauté Économique Européenne, as they said it, they called it in French. I think that Italy is sending a clear message, the electorate, that immigration remains like an issue the entire union has to confront together. It's a responsibility that they had to assume by themselves mainly, and the electorate used that issue to say, okay, that's enough. We're going to do something. It's a populist answer. It could have been the League. We're talking about the League in the Five Star Movement. The League is really a far right wing anti-immigration party, and Giuseppe Conte is not in this, thankfully. I think before seeing Italy leaving the Union, I think we will have to see all the Europeans work together to make sure that Italy feels comfortable in this Union with its immigrant reality.
Well, certainly the European Union and its functionaries have a lot to do with keeping Italy happy, managing the exit of the UK. It's going to be an interesting year, to say the least. Before we close, I just wanted to say a quick word about a thing that happened that really made me smile, which is kind of a rarity these days with the news when you read it, which is 22-year-old Mamadou Gassama, an immigrant from Mali, rescued a 4-year-old boy who was dangling from a fourth-floor balcony of a Paris apartment. Gassama, who had immigrated across all of continental Africa, across the Mediterranean. He climbed 4 floors in 30 seconds to rescue a child whose parent had been someplace playing video games or some such. And the rescue was rewarded by the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, who granted citizenship to Mamadou Gassama. So I feel good about it. He's been nicknamed Spider-Man in France. I think it's an amazing story about his escape, but it's an amazing story about his rescue, and may it cast maybe a different light on the subject of immigration across Western Europe. That could be our only hope. So I just want to close with that one, because that is all the time we have for this week. I want to thank our panelists, Emily Tamkin, writer for the magazine Foreign Policy, and Richard Latendresse, of Canadian broadcaster TVA Nouvelle. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor in Washington. Thanks for listening.